Namo Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prasthaya Bhutale Srimati Bhaktivinanta Samarita Namani Namaste Saraswati Devi Guru Vani Sajani Navasetya Sanyavada Vishkati Vizita Om Akilita Mirandasya Jirajana Salakaya Saksu Samilitan Jena Tasmai Sri Gurave Namaha Sri Chaitanya Manavistam Stapitam Dena Bhutale Sayam Prakadamayam Dadati Sa Pandantikam. Vanshikaputrubhasya Gibhasanduvai Maja Patitanam Pabinebhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namah. Towards the end of the sixth chapter of the sixth canto in the chapter entitled The Progeny of the Daughters of Daksha, there was a list of so many persons born from Daksha, and due to those descendants the universe became populated. Towards the end of that chapter, it described how Rachana, who was a daughter of the Daityas, that means Diti, became the wife of Prajapati Tvasta, and their child was named Vishwarupa. And Vishwarupa became the spiritual master, this is what was described, of the demigods when Brihaspati abandoned his disciples, the demigods. So at that point, at the beginning of chapter 7, this was at the end of chapter 6, beginning of chapter 7, Maharaj Prakrit became curious to understand what was the cause of Brihaspati's rejection of his disciples, the demigods. What did they do? What offense did they commit? So as a result of that question, several chapters of the Bhagavatam 6th canto were described, which ended with Indra taking shelter of Vishwarupa, and then him killing Vishwarupa, and then him getting the then Vritrasura coming, and then Arayankaracha being given to him, and Vritrasura was eventually killed by the Vajra, or the thunderbolt of Indra, which was made under the instructions of Lord Narayan. Then Vritrasura showed himself, revealed himself to be such a great devotee, so powerful, so detached from his body, so desirous of going to the spiritual world, that he had no attachment at all to inhabiting that particular body that he had, even though he was an asura, he was a demonic personality. Because one who is demonic is afflicted by the modes of passion and ignorance. And when one is being beaten by the whips, the sticks and the whips of passion and ignorance, one has complete attachment to one's body and one's mind. One completely identifies with these things. The mode of passion fills us with so many desires. I want, I want, I want. And when one has many, many, many desires, that means one has many unfulfilled desires. Because no one is satisfied by fulfilling one's desires. One really becomes satisfied by renouncing one's desires. So someone who is afflicted by passion with so many desires, how could he be speaking and acting? Not only speaking, it's one thing to speak, but to act in a completely detached way. And such a great devotee of Lord Narayan. So Prakrit Maharaj asked about this. How is this possible? And the result of that question were the next chapters, which describe how Chitraketu Maharaj didn't have a son, and Angira Muni decided to give him a son with the purpose of really giving him bhakti or devotional service. But when one has desires for a son or filled with desires born of passion, then the, practically speaking, the last thing one wants is to give them up and to take to devotional service, which means vairagya vidya nija bhakti yoga, detachment. So Angira Muni allowed Chitraketu to have a son, but that son died very early, poisoned. And as a result, Narada Muni came and gave, at that time when he was suffering so much, Chitraketu was suffering so much, his heart was opened, softened by the suffering. Because when we're successful, our hearts tend to become hardened, thinking only about fulfilling more of our desires and not caring about anyone else at all. So, in pain, we ask questions about what is the value of this? Why am I doing this? And the heart becomes soft and is ready for some compassion to enter. Artha jigyasa, artha tighyani cha bharatasava. Krishna explains this in the 7th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, how one who comes, artha jigyasa, artha ti, one who is in distress can come to Krishna. He's a kind of devotee wishing his distress removed, because when one's in distress, what does one want? One wants his distress removed. So, Chitraketu then, after receiving transcendental knowledge and mantras from Narada Muni, he practiced those mantras in a perfect way with determination, and very, very quickly, within a week, he actually had darshan of Lord Narayan. And very wonderful prayers, words were exchanged between Chitraketu Maharaj and the Lord. And then the final chapter we read last week was how Chitraketu, in an intermediate position of king of the Vidyadharas, he unintentionally spoke a criticism of Lord Shiva. It wasn't actually a criticism, he was just expressing something. And he was cursed by Parvati to become a demon, which explains how he became Vritrasura. But the end of that described when Lord Shiva was explaining to Parvati that this was actually inappropriate for her to curse Chitraketu, even though he had said something. It wasn't taken in a bad way, actually. But see, he explained, see how incredible this Chitraketu actually is due to his devotional service. Narayana Paraksave Nakutastana Bibhyati. He's not afraid, because when he was cursed to become a demon, to die, and to take a horrible birth, his mind was focused on Krishna. So therefore, swargapavaganarakeshu apituyata darshana. For a devotee whose mind is actually focused on Krishna, swargapavaganarakeshu, whether he's in heaven or hell, or liberated, doesn't make any difference. Never afraid This is actually the perfection of consciousness. And Mahaprabhu therefore prayed, Nadjanam, Nadjanam, the Sundarim, Kavitam va Jagadisha Kamani, Mama Janamani, Janamani, Shere, Bhavat Tad Bhakti, Ahaitiki, Tai. Nadjanam, Nadjanam, the Sundarim. I don't want anything of the material world. Nor do I want liberation from the material world, but all I want is that my consciousness is fixed as a servant of your lotus feet. And therefore the next verse Mahaprabhu says, Ayi Nanda Tunuja Kinkaram. Oh Lord Krishna, son of Nanda Maharaj, somehow or another, although I am your servant, I have fallen into this ocean of birth and death. Please pick me up from this ocean of death and place me as your servant again, as an atom of your lotus feet. So Lord Shiva and Parvati were marveling at the consciousness, at the power of a devotee. A real devotee can tolerate anything on the material level, thinking it's superficial, because of the depth of his own Krishna consciousness. So naturally, after hearing about the glories, even Lord Shiva and Parvati, practically the mother and father of the material world, how they're glorifying the devotion of Chitraketu and the position of a devotee, naturally one wants to become a devotee. But when we look at our qualification for becoming a devotee, thinking of Krishna all the time, all material desires finished, just attached to Krishna, one might become very discouraged about becoming a devotee if that's a prerequisite. But now, in the next chapter, which is the next to last chapter of the sixth canto of the Bhagavatam, we're going to get some other lessons to encourage us. I'm going to read more or less the first 36 verses here, where we'll stop and then we'll speak about some of the points, and if Krishna allows, we'll complete the chapter tomorrow. So we had heard how the story of Vritrasura and Chitraketu stemmed from hearing about how Vishwarup, the son of Rachana, the daughter of Diti, was killed, he became the priest of the demigods. And then we heard about Vritrasura and Chitraketu Maharaj as an offshoot of that. So now Sukadeva Goswami is going to continue where he left off before those two stories entered, which are actually one story, two lives of one person. And he's going to continue describing more progeny. So he says in the first verse, Sukadeva Goswami said, this is chapter 18, Prishni, who is the wife of Savita, the fifth of the 12 sons of Aditi, gave birth to three daughters, Savitri, Vyariti, and Trayi, and the son named Agnihotra, Pashu, Soma, Chaturmasya, and the five Mahayagyas. O king, Siddhi, who is the wife of Bhaga, the sixth son of Aditi, bore three sons named Mahima, Vibhu, and Prabhu, and one extremely beautiful daughter whose name was Ashi. Datta, the seventh son of Aditi, had four wives named Kuhu, Srinivali, Raka, and Anumati. These wives begot four sons named Saman, Darsha, Pratapunamasa, respectively. The wife of Vidhata, the eighth son of Aditi, was named Kriya. In her, Vidhata begot the five fire gods named Purushyas. It's the wife of Varuna. The ninth son of Aditi was named Charshani. The wife of Varuna, the ninth son of Aditi, was named Charshani. Bhrigu, the son of Brahma, took birth again in her womb. By the semen of Varuna, the great mystic Valmiki took birth from an anthill. Bhrigu and Valmiki were specific sons of Varuna, whereas Agastya and Vishishta Rishi were the common sons of Varuna and Mitra, the tenth son of Aditya. You saw there's so many descendants here. So we'll hear some more. So these personalities, they're all famous in the Puranas and the Vedic scriptures. But upon seeing Orvasi, the celestial society girl, both Mitra and Varuna discharged semen, which they preserved in an earthen pot. The two sons, Agastya and Vasishta, later appeared from that pot. And they are therefore the common sons of Mitra and Varuna. Mitra begot three sons in the womb of his wife, whose name was Revati. Their names were Utsarga, Adist, and Pipala. Prabhupada explains in a very short purport how modern science is trying to generate living entities in test tubes by processing semen. But even long ago, long, long ago, it was possible for semen to be kept in a pot to develop into a child. Continuing all the descendants of Daksha here, of Aditi. O King Prickit, Indra, the king of the heavenly planets, and 11th son of Aditi, begot three sons named Jayanta, Rishabha, and Medusa in the womb of his wife, Pulomi. Thus we have heard. By his own potency, the supreme personality of Godhead, who has multifarious potencies, by his own potency, the Lord, the supreme personality of Godhead, who himself has multifarious potency, has so many potencies. He appeared in the form of a dwarf as Arukram, the 12th son of Aditi. So what's another name of Arukram? Vamanadeva. So the Lord, by his own potency, his Atmamaya, by his own potency, took his birth as the son of Aditi, as a dwarf. In the womb of his wife, whose name was Kirti, he begot one son named Brihatsloka, who had many sons, headed by Sobhaga. Later, in the 8th canto of the Srimad Bhagavatam, I shall describe how Arukrama, Lord Vamadeva, appeared as the son of the great sage Kasyapa, and how he covered the three worlds with three steps. I shall describe the uncommon activities he performed, his qualities, his power, and how he took birth from the womb of Aditi. So this is something to look forward to. The 8th canto of the Bhagavatam is quite an epic. It's actually an incredible canto. It's much larger than life. It's very wonderful. But before we get to the 8th canto, we have to cross over the 7th canto and immerse in ourselves in the incredible pastime of Prahlad Maharaj and try to understand the wonderful exalted consciousness of Prahlad Maharaj. And it's also, it gives us a hint about Prahlad Maharaj. He was so pure, he was so simple-hearted in his devotion. He was so free from anxiety due to his dependence on Krishna. And he was just a boy, a young 5-year-old lad. But so sweet and innocent in his fixedness, in his dependence on Krishna, like a child. We also have to become like that, simple-hearted in that way, in our dependence on Krishna. So we'll hear about that in the next canto, which, if Krishna allows, we may actually begin next week. So, Lord Vamandev, who covers the three worlds, Trivikram, with three steps, covers the entire universe, will be discussed in the 8th canto. And he also took birth from the womb of Aditi. So now he's completed all the sons of Aditi, who are known as Adityas. Now, in text 10, Sukadeva says, Now let me describe the sons of Diti. So there's Aditi, Aditi and Diti, two sisters. All these demigods, Lord Indra and other demigods, were born of Aditi. And who was born of Diti? We've already heard two of her sons of Kasyapa Muni in the third canto of the Bhagavatam. And who were those two sons? Haranyaksha and Haranyakashipu. So the sons of Diti were demons, and the sons of Aditi were demigods. Now let me describe the sons of Diti who were begotten by Kasyapa but who became demons. And this demoniac family, the great devotee Prahlad Maharaj appeared, and Bali Maharaj also appeared in that family. The demons are technically known as daityas because they proceeded from the womb of Diti. First, the two sons named Haranyakashipu and Haranyaka took birth from Diti's womb. Both of them were very powerful and were worshipped by the daityas and Janavas. So we've heard about the incredible power of Haranyaka, how he fought with Lord Varaha and was killed by him. We've heard of that in the third canto. The wife of Haranyakashipu is known as Kayadu. She was the daughter of Jamba and a descendant of Danu. She gave birth to four consecutive sons known as Samlad, Anulad, Lada, and Pralad. The sisters of these four sons were known as Samika, the sister. Her name was Samika. She married the demon named Viprachit and gave birth to another demon named Rahu. While Rahu, in disguise, was drinking nectar among the demigods, the Supreme Personality of Godhead severed his head. That will be described in a very wonderful and interesting pastime, how that he was drinking nectar. What is the Sanskrit word for nectar? Amrita. So what is the Sanskrit word for death? Mritya. So Amrita is no death. If one drinks this nectar, there is no death. So everyone is actually interested in drinking that nectar of no death, or attaining no death. So the eighth canto of the Bhagavatam will explain how we can get that, and how we can't get that, even though we may endeavor and churn for a very long time. The wife of Samlada was named Kriti. By union with Samlad, Kriti gave birth to a son named Panchajana. The wife of Lada was named Damani. She gave birth to two sons named Vatapi and Ilval. When Agastya Muni became Ilval's guest, Ilvala served him a feast by cooking Vatapi, who was in the shape of a ram. So there's a, this is in the Mahabharata or Ramayana? Where he had an ability to bring himself together after being cut apart. So they used to kill people in this way. He'd chop himself up and people would eat him. And then he would put himself together and break them apart. The wife of Anulad was named Surya. So he said, this is a demonic family. She gave birth to two sons named Bashkal and Mahisha. Prahlad had one son, Virochana, whose wife gave birth to Bali Maharaj. Thereafter, Bali Maharaj begot 100 sons in the womb of Asan. Of these 100 sons, King Bana was the eldest. The activities of Bali Maharaj, which are very laudable, which will be described later in the eighth canto. Since King Bana was a great worshipper of Lord Shiva, he became one of Lord Shiva's most celebrated associates. Even now, Lord Shiva protects King Bana's capital and always stands beside him. The 49 Maruts, demigods, were also born from the womb of Diti. Now, what seems inconsistent about that? The demigods are born from Aditi, and the demons are born from Diti. But yet, these 49 Maruts, who are the wind gods, they, although born from Diti, were demigods. Although they were born from Diti, King Indra gave them a position as demigods. Now, this... why did this happen? Do you know? No, don't try and answer. I know it. You'd say something wild. But there is a reason for this. And it is wild, actually. It is amazing. It is wonderful. And from the pastime that we're going to hear, because Prickit Maharaj inquires how this happened, how the Maruts became born, took birth, and became demigods, we're going to hear some encouraging information about the requirements of practicing devotional service and the potency of devotional service, even though we may not be qualified with the right motives. So King Prickit inquired, text 20, "My dear Lord, due to their birth, the 49 Maruts must have been obsessed with a demoniac mentality. Why did Indra, the King of Heaven, convert them into demigods? Why did they perform any rituals or pious activities? How did this happen? My dear Brahmana, I and all the sages present with me are eager to know about this. Therefore, O great soul, kindly explain to us the reason." Sri Suta Goswami said, "O great sage Shonaka," so Suta is describing what he's heard from Prickit, from his own hearing the conversation between Prickit Maharaj and Sukadev Goswami. So he's relating this to the sages of Namasharanya and Suta Goswami. Suta is relating this to the sages of Namasharanya headed by Shonaka. So Suta says, "O great sage Shonaka, after hearing Maharaj Prickit speak respectfully and briefly on topics essential to hear, Sukadev Goswami, who is well aware of everything, praised his endeavor with great pleasure and replied." We'll read that short purport by Prabhupada here. "Maharaj Prickit's question was very much appreciated by Sukadev Goswami, because although it was composed of a small number of words, it contained meaningful inquiries about how the sons of Diti, although born as demons, became demigods. Srila Vishwanatha Chakravarti Thakur stresses that even though Diti was very envious, her heart was purified because of a devotional attitude," and we'll hear about this. "Another significant topic is that although Kasyapa Muni was a learned scholar and was advanced in spiritual consciousness, he nonetheless fell a victim to the inducements of his beautiful wife. All these questions were posed in a small number of words, and therefore Sukadev Goswami very much appreciated Maharaj Prickit's inquiry." So he's going to continue here. "See, Sukadev Goswami said, just to help Indra," so we're going back into pastime now, "just to help Indra, Lord Vishnu killed the two brothers, Hiranyaksha and Hiranyakashipu. Because of their being killed, their mother Diti, overwhelmed with lamentation and anger, contemplated as follows." Again, we've heard about the killing of Hiranyaksha in Canto 3, and in Canto 7, we'll hear about Hiranyakashipu's being killed by Lord Nisringadev. So, the point that's making here, to help Indra, Lord Vishnu killed the two brothers. Now, remember this, because this point will come up in the beginning of Canto 7 as well. "Lord Indra, 24, who is very much fond of sense gratification," and he's an exalted demigod, a devotee, "has killed the two brothers, Hiranyaksha and Hiranyakashipu, by means of Lord Vishnu." This is what Diti is thinking. Excuse me. This is what Diti is contemplating, because she's very angry because her children have been killed because of Indra. So this is what she's saying. Lord Indra is very much fond of sense gratification, so she's accusing him of being an enjoyer, a sense enjoyer. Has killed the two brothers, Hiranyaksha and Hiranyakashipu, by means of Lord Vishnu. So she's seeing that it's Indra who has killed her two sons. Therefore, Indra is cruel, hard-hearted, and sinful. When will I, having killed him, rest with a pacified mind? So she has become envious because her sons have been killed. When dead, the bodies of all the rulers known as kings and great leaders will be transformed into worms, stool, or ashes. If one enviously kills another for the protection of such a body, does he actually know the true interest of life? Certainly he does not. If one is envious of other entities, he surely goes to hell. In other words, if we defend ourselves from someone who's attacking us, she's saying, thinking that defense is going to save us from death, we are certainly an illusion, because nothing can save us from death. Because everyone, our bodies, which may be protected for some time, will ultimately end up as either stool, worms, or ashes, depending upon how the body is disposed of. If it's burned after death, it turns into ashes. If it's buried, it turns into worms. And if it's some religious cultures, traditions, they take dead bodies. When one of their own dies, they take the dead body and they feed it to the vultures or dogs. Why? Because they want some benefit to come from the dead body, that the body is useful to at least help some other living entities, provide some food. And even in Vrindavan, when they burn the bodies, when even devotees, when a body is burned, there's always a little bit at the end that's saved, and it's thrown into the Yamuna to feed the turtles. So if that's going to happen to one's body and there's nothing one can do about it, it's quite a frightening thought, isn't it? There's nothing one can do about it. When we're young, we don't think about it. But as we get older, we start noticing, hey, wait a second. It's already happening. My body's already dying. It's already dying. Right now it's dying. So it's not very intelligent to hurt others to protect the body. This is the argument that she's giving. Protect the body that's doomed anyway. What is the benefit of that? So Prabhupada explains in the purport, when one is too attached to the bodily conception of life, he's certainly not very intelligent. So Ditti continues, text 26. Indra considers his body eternal, and thus he has become unrestrained. I therefore wish to have a son who can remove Indra's madness. Let me adopt some means to help me in this. So Ditti wanted to punish Indra, who had become like a lower animal, so attached to the body. So in her criticism of Indra, she's actually criticizing us, because we'll do anything for our body, anything, everything for our body. So attached to something that is fleeting, and everything connected to the body. Text 28. Thinking in this way, trying to get a son to kill Indra, with a desire for a son to kill Indra, Ditti began constantly acting to satisfy Kasyapa by her pleasing behavior. So she made a plan. Now, how am I going to get a son who's so powerful that Indra will be killed by him. So we heard, so Diti has a particular mentality. And she started serving her husband, Kasyapa Muni, to gain a benediction from him. And so he will give her a son. So also in the third canto, we've heard about another plan that Diti had to have a son. And she wanted the son right now. And she chose an inauspicious time. And she got her husband, Kasyapa, at that time to promise her. She pleased him. And he promised her, whatever you want. And she wanted a son. And she's going to do a similar tactic right now. So the result of that combination of husband and wife, when the mentalities weren't proper and the time wasn't proper, everything was inauspicious, and the result of that was the birth of Hiranyakashipu and Hiranyaksha, two great demons. So Diti here has another plan. So Diti always carried out Kasyapa's orders very faithfully, as he desired, with service, love, humility, and control, with words spoken very sweetly to satisfy her husband, and with smiles and glances at him. Diti attracted his mind and brought it, which was his mind, under her control. Prabhupada explains in his purport. When a woman wants to endear herself to her husband and make him very faithful, she must try to please him in all respects. When the husband is pleased with his wife, the wife can receive all necessities, ornaments, and full satisfaction for her senses. Herein, this is indicated by the behavior of Diti. Although Kasyapa Muni, text 29, was a learned scholar, he was captivated by Diti's artificial behavior, which brought him under her control. Therefore, he assured his wife that he would fulfill her desire. Such a promise by a husband is not very astonishing. So there's some purports here, but we'll come back to that. Oh, my dear one, the most powerful sage, Kasyapa, being extremely pleased by the mild behavior of his wife, Diti, smiled and spoke to her as follows. So she had pleased him, and then he began to speak to her. Kasyapa Muni said, oh, beautiful woman, oh, irreproachable lady, since I'm very much pleased by your behavior, you may ask me for any benediction you want. If a husband is pleased, what desires are difficult for his wife to obtain, either in this world or in the next? A husband is the supreme demigod for a woman, the supreme personality of Godhead. Lord Vasudev, the husband of the goddess of fortune, is situated in everyone's heart and is worshipped through the various names and forms of the demigods by fruitive workers. Similarly, a husband represents the Lord as the object of worship for a woman. My dear wife, whose body is so beautiful, your waist being thin, a conscientious wife should be chaste and should abide by the orders of her husband. She should very devoutly worship her husband as a representative of Vasudev. My dear gentle wife, because you have worshipped me with great devotion, considering me a representative of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, I shall reward you by fulfilling your desires, which are unobtainable for an unchaste wife. So now, Kasyapa has given Diti what she wanted. He has written her a blank check. What do you want? She's asked him. Whatever you want, you have pleased me so much by your behavior, by your faithful way of caring for me, of serving me. Now I will give you whatever you want. And that's what Diti was waiting for. We'll read a couple of purports here. Here in text 30, didn't. Yeah, it describes how Diti promised her, how Diti brought Kasyapa Muni under control. I didn't read this verse, actually. In the beginning of creation, Lord Brahma, the father of living entities of the universe, saw that the living entities were unattached. To increase population, he then created woman from the better half of a man's body, for woman's behavior carries away a man's mind. Purport. The entire universe is going on under the spell of sexual attachment, which was created by Lord Brahma to increase the population of the entire universe, not only in human society, but also in other species. As stated by Rishabhdev in the fifth canto, Pumsa Striya Matuni Bhava Metan, the entire world is going on under the spell of sexual attraction and desire between man and woman. When man and woman unite, the hard knot of this attraction becomes increasingly tight, and thus a man is implicated in the materialistic way of life. This is the illusion of the material world, because this attraction between man and woman, it focuses the consciousness of both the man and woman, actually, as the enjoyer, which is the essence of false ego, the essence of improper identity. Purusha prakriti stohi bhunte prakriti janiha karanam guna sangasya places one, that mood of I am the enjoyer, places one in the grip of the material energy and sarasa joni janmasu. It causes birth and death and birth and death. As long as we have the mood of, or the mentality of being the enjoyer, then we are not in proper consciousness. We are in false consciousness, false ego. We don't know our identity. We are not living who we truly are. And sex life especially places one in that consciousness, because it creates a fever in the consciousness of enjoyment. I want to enjoy, I want to enjoy. So this is called illusion or maya. This is the illusion, Prabhupada says, of the material world. The illusion acted upon Kasyapa Muni, although he was very learned and advanced in spiritual knowledge, as stated in the Manusamhita and Srimad Bhagavatam, Matra Svasra Duhitrava Navi Viktasanobhave Balavan Indira Gramam Vidvasam Apikar Shati. A man should not associate with a woman in a solitary place, not even with his mother, sister, or daughter. For the senses are so strong that they lead astray even a person advanced in knowledge. In other words, this tendency to want to exploit material nature or another, exploit is the word, the tendency to want to exploit another body as if it was made for our pleasure, its existence was for our pleasure, is just below the surface. So therefore this verse from the Bhagavatam and the Manusamhita cautions us to be very careful about that. And the mind tends to latch on so tightly to this, to enjoyable sense objects, that which we deem to be enjoyable. So therefore, he was very strongly cautioned, even that can lead astray even a person advanced in knowledge. When a man remains in a solitary place with a woman, his sexual desires undoubtedly increase. Therefore the word ekantabhutani, which are used here, indicate that to avoid sexual desires, one should avoid the company of women, and of course, women with men, as far as possible. Sexual desire is so powerful that one is saturated with it if he stays in a solitary place with any woman, even his mother, sister, or daughter. So very strong cautionary words are given here. So Prabhupada was citing this as an example of how Kasyapa Muni, even though he was very, very learned, he became under the spell of illusion. The illusion. Another part of a purport here. Talking about a woman seeing her husband and serve as an object of worship. So how politically incorrect is this? It can't get more politically incorrect than talking about the woman's or wife supposed to serve her husband in this day and age. It's just not accepted. But Prabhupada, actually the Bhagavatam verse itself explains it. And Prabhupada says in his purport, if women who are usually very much attached to their husbands worship their husbands as representatives of Vasudeva, the women benefit, just as Ajamil benefited by calling for Narayan, his son. Ajamil was concerned with his son, but because of his attachment to the name of Narayan, he attained salvation simply by chanting that name. In India, a husband is still called Patiguru, the husband's spiritual master. If husband and wife are attached to one another for advancement in Krishna consciousness, their relationship of cooperation is very effective for such advancement. Though the names of Indra and Agni are sometimes uttered in the Vedic mantras, Indriya Swaha, Agnaye Swaha, the Vedic sacrifices are actually performed for the satisfaction of Lord Vishnu. As long as one is very much attached to material sense gratification, the worship of the demigods or the worship of one's husband is recommended. So, different points are being made here. The gradual progress, one can worship for gradual progress in spiritual life, one can worship the demigods, or a wife can worship, be chaste and worship her husband. But ultimately, if one is married, in the most proper way, the center should not be sense gratification, but cooperation for advancement in Krishna consciousness. And Prabhupada even says here, that relationship then, the relationship of cooperation, is very effective for such advancement. But Krishna is to be the center in such a relationship. And that is the key, and that is the hard point to remember and to fulfill. And one last and we'll stop here. Any questions or comments? So up to the point in the pastime of how Kasyapa Muni has said to his wife, you have pleased me and therefore you ask me for anything and I will bestow it upon you. And he was a very, very powerful Muni. Yes?
How do you get rid of sin?
How do we get rid of the spirit in our heart of we want to be the center, the enjoyer? Yeah, well, that's the whole process of sadhana bhakti, of Krishna consciousness. We want to change our identification, because naturally one wants pleasure. But one looks for pleasure in different ways depending upon who he thinks he is. But we have to negate who we're not and establish ourselves in who we are. That's the process that we're trying to achieve. Certain things have to be negated. Illusion has to be negated. In other words, if I'm thinking I'm Napoleon, or if I'm thinking I'm Julius Caesar, or Emperor Akbar, for me to understand who I really am, I have to get rid of those illusory identities. I have to forget that false sense of who I am. So we have to negate who we are not. That the illusion has to be negated. But we don't, that doesn't mean that everything has to be negated. What has to be established positively is who we are. And who are we? We are Krishnas. So if we become established in our identity as I am Krishna's servant, and if we develop the heart of bhakti, of I want to please Krishna, I want to satisfy Krishna, oh Krishna, please allow me to serve you. So if we adopt that identity, Jivera Srupoi Krishner Nityadas Gopi Bharta Pada Kamalayodasa Dasanodas, that I'm Krishna's servant. I'm not Napoleon, I'm not Julius Caesar, I'm not Joan of Arc, I'm not Cleopatra, I'm not Bill Gates, I'm not anything actually connected to the body. I'm an eternal soul, and the nature of the soul is that it's Krishna's servant. So if we awaken that, then everything is perfect. Then we have no false ego. Then we have real ego, real identity. Now the problem is, how can we do that? How do we get out of illusion when we're in illusion? We're in illusion, so how do we get out? It's fine to say, I'm Krishna's servant, I'm not this, I'm not my body. But how are we going to act on that level? How are we going to deeply realize that? So we have to practice sadhana bhakti. But this pastime, especially in the second half of this chapter, we're going to hear how one is purified of the falsity of identity. And when the falsity of identity is removed, the heart is cleansed of the falseness, then we become established in who we actually are. So that's actually the subject of the, will be clearly indicated in the second half. How can we, who are in illusion, get to the point of purity? That's the question that's being asked. We've heard in the last chapter how glorious devotional service is, how pure it is. A devotee doesn't care about anything except remembering Krishna. But here we are, not in that consciousness. We're interested in enjoyment. We think we're the center of the universe of existence. We think everything should revolve around us. When it doesn't, we become angry. How dare it not revolve around me? Because I'm the center, my body, my mind. So, how to not be discouraged by the fact that we have impurities, that we're not pure devotees, and how to move on in devotional service and still take it up and come to the ultimate goal. So the glorious potency of devotion we'll hear about tomorrow, to do this, to devotional service. But the whole question of how to do it is the whole process of Krishna consciousness. It begins with chanting Hare Krishna, breaking the tightest knots that bind us to the material world. Therefore we follow, which are the four pillars of sinful life. When we say something is sinful, there's a tendency to think, oh, it's sinful, it's very bad, it's inherently bad. But why is it bad? Why is it sinful? What makes it sinful? What adverse effect does it have? The adverse effect that it has is that sinful activities, meat eating, illicit sex, intoxication, gambling, they cover the consciousness so deeply that we become bound to the bodily conception of life. We become our bodies. The mind becomes fixed in bodily consciousness. So therefore, on one side, we have to refrain from those things, and on the other side, we chant Hare Krishna and engage in the other processes and always try to remember Krishna and never forget him. Sadhana bhakti. Sadhana means practice. Okay, any other questions? Yeah.
Well, the last few verses were about a husband and wife. This is this doesn't really come from the Western society. Is there a I found it hard to relate to this because it's just... Because
you've been brought up in a completely different way.
Yeah.
What you said that to Prabhupada, didn't you, Jagtuni? That exact question. Because Prabhupada told her. she should consider herself my maidservant. Not that we want to bring this out every time, but... Now, can you imagine that? A Western woman like that, and you know, maybe if I was Hercules or something like that, or or some, you know, powerful great hero, something like that, then it may could romantically think in that way.
He didn't exactly say that.
What didn't he say? Okay, you tell the story.
With
this guy. Didn't he say something about maidservant?
No.
I made that up.
You made
that up. She was.
But he didn't
say I was supposed to serve. Oh, I didn't make that part up.
And he said I was supposed to be satisfied with Indian culture. This wife, wherever she goes, it doesn't matter, whatever else is there, she's just with her husband. As long as she's with her husband, she's completely satisfied. She can be in the situation.
Serve was there, wasn't it?
Maybe.
The word serve? Yes, it was there.
She has the duties in the cupboard, and she doesn't need anything more, she doesn't need any opulences or anything. She's just simple. Happy because she's serving her husband.
Oh, yes. Yes,
and
dear.
I said, I wasn't brought up in this culture. That's a little shock.
Yes.
And he said, he looked at me very reasonably. He didn't try to argue the point, and he said, I know your ways are different, he said, but if something is good, why not try for it? That was reasonable.
See, we should also notice that aside from the fact that no one in the West is brought up in that way, the way that they are brought up hasn't worked. That we should note. It's not like marriages stayed together and things have changed over the last 50 years, 100 years. So, you know, now if the man is equal, if it equal, it used to be equal, but now I don't think it's that anymore. You know, the women, you know, it's the golden rule. You know the golden rule? The golden rule is he who has the gold makes the rules. So when the women are working and they're making the money and the man is staying home taking care of the house, then who makes the rules? Who rules? It's the woman who's going to rule. So although things have changed and that this system seems very old-fashioned and it's hard to implant, the new system hasn't worked. It's not that there's no divorces and everyone's happy in this way. Factually, the families are breaking apart like anything, and the children grow up with one parent. The percentages are actually staggering. Australia and United States, and they're staggering. The percentages of the percentage of divorce rate nowadays. Anyone know what the statistics are? But it's 50%. So, and when I was growing up, I never even met anyone who was divorced. So that means, I mean, if you have two people in charge, you know, it just doesn't work. Someone's got to be in charge. So that's actually the practical reality of it. Now, how to deal with it in a practical sense? Since we weren't brought up in that way. So you know, it seems to me that it's not easy, that's one thing. And just knowing that this is the ideal, the Vedic culture is ideal, it doesn't help that much in the sense that it doesn't make it easy. just by knowing that this is superior, because the different tendencies are there. But this is a long discussion how to deal with that, and one has to act practically too.
It's also important that Srila Prabhupada, even in that conversation, gave very firm guidelines for the qualities and character of the husband who is supposed to be respected in this world. He didn't just say it.
Well, that, of course, let's see. Yeah, that the husband should be a representative of the Lord. He should be a proper husband.
So if neither people are trying for that, you can't.
One thing that I was told that helped me understand what to do is that when husbands are dealing with wives, usually the husband will say to the wife, "You're supposed to surrender to me. You're supposed to do what I say. You're supposed to serve me." And then the wife will say to the husband, "Well, you're supposed to be a representative of the Lord. You have to be more than you are." So it's a typical thing with everyone telling the other person what their duty is. So if it's just changed around, and instead of the husband telling the wife what she's supposed to be doing, and the wife telling the husband what he's supposed to be doing, if the husband will tell himself what he's supposed to be doing, that he has to come to a high standard, and the wife tells herself she should serve properly, then that envious bickering doesn't happen as much. That endless envious bickering doesn't happen as much. Because one thing is, because when you see that you're not up to the highest standard, then you're more tolerant with the partner not being up to the highest standard either. But yet, if people are sincerely trying to improve, that's very good. And as it, when I was teaching, I learned that that's basically the teacher's definition of when a student is doing well, is if they're doing better. If you're continuously getting better, that's very, very good. You can't really ask for much more than that. So it's obviously a big topic, and so much can be said. But you should know you're not alone. And it has to be worked out with the two individuals too. But it's good if it's worked out before they get married. Because when people get married, there's like a dream that's going on. Like they've seen so many movies and heard so many fairy tales, and the woman has a Prince Charming in her mind. And the man has different things in their mind. but the first so many years of marriage is trying to make the other person into your dream. This is my experience in the West. It's not like this in a typical Vedic culture. Trying to make the person fulfill your dream. And the other person's trying to make you fulfill their dream. And therefore, it's not a very peaceful relationship in the beginning. In Vrindavan, what they do is when... it's just so completely different from the West, is that the girl gets married, and the first thing, she moves out of her house. And she moves into the house of her husband. But he's not alone there. She's not exactly, the wife isn't put under the husband's charge. She's put under the charge of her mother-in-law, who's in charge of training her. And therefore, because different families always will have different standards in cooking and cleanliness and how you do this and how you do that. So the first thing is and even in the Western culture, you change your name. The woman changed her name to the husband's surname. So she moves So you're changing your family, so you have to learn all the standards of that family, and you're put in charge of the mother-in-law. And you see it in Vrindavan that the ladies, the young wives especially, when they walk outside, they have their heads completely covered. Not only their heads covered like that, but their faces covered too. Like they walk around like that, so no man could see them like that. And they walk behind their mother-in-law, and they never go out alone.
And they keep their heads, faces fully covered in the house with their
older brother.
And the older men in the family.
Yeah.
Even when they're cooking and everything,
South India is like that?
Yeah.
Nepal?
Everywhere.
It's very heavy. But obviously that they're born and then as soon as there's an alternative it doesn't work. And as soon as there's the internet, it doesn't work. And as soon as they're watching the movies, the Bombay movies and the Madrasi movies, it doesn't work either. So the culture falls apart. But as women are liberated from this culture, the result isn't positive either. So this is Kali Yuga. Kali Yuga, and then you see that why women don't like that, because they're not treated properly in that. So that's what happens in Kali Yuga, that authority is bad, becomes bad, and then people want to escape from the authority, and then everyone becomes their own authority. So you're damned if you do and you're damned if you don't in Kali Yuga. So what we try to do is work it out practically, chant Hare Krishna, become purified, and get out of the mess of Kali Yuga and go back to the spiritual world.
Better not to marry.
Huh?
Said it better not to marry now.
It's better not to marry if one can be properly unmarried. But it's better to marry than be improperly unmarried. But it's better to marry and stay married and be happy in Krishna consciousness. And what did Prabhupada say? He said, be happy wherever you are with your husband. Yes, dear. Is that all right, dear? Better not to marry. No one knows what it's like being married till they get married. And the Western idea nowadays, because they've seen the disasters in marriage, so what the kids grow up with the idea is, well, marriage is so difficult that I'm going to live with a woman for a good few years before see how compatible we actually are. But that doesn't work either. That hasn't slowed down divorce either. Statistics prove or show that doesn't at all help marriage. And then the other thing is now, the idea now, the new agey concept of marriage is you're not married, you have a partner. You're in relationship and you have a partner. And the rule of partnership is as long as this relationship is good for both of us, is helpful to both of us, we'll stay together. But as soon as it's not, we're free to leave. We don't owe each other anything. And the result of that is a disaster too. And what about the kids? Sorry. This is no longer good for me anymore. After all, we've been together for 30 years and you're already old and wrinkled, and there's a new one that's young and wrinkle-free nearby, so this one isn't good for me anymore. So I'm going to move on. But what about us, Dad? Sorry, you're not good for me either. So this is Kali Yuga. It's all crazy and upside down. So the idea is that within culture, within a proper culture, the plant of devotion grows so naturally and easily. So without that culture being intact, it's so difficult that Krishna so kindly has given us a very simple methodology, and that's to chant Hare Krishna. And although chanting Hare Krishna was always there, Srila Jiva Goswami explains that in Kali Yuga there's so much distress. There's so much distress. Everything is distress. Making money is distress. Eating food, you're afraid of this, of the insecticides and this and that. And things are canned. Eating is distress. Marriage is difficult. The children are difficult. Everything is difficult in Kali Yuga. There's diseases, communicable diseases are difficult. People, everyone's in debt. Afraid of the petrol running out, afraid of thieves. There's so much anxiety in Kali Yuga. But that anxiety has a hidden blessing in it. And that constant anxiety has the hidden blessing that if we will just chant Hare Krishna, whenever we get an anxiety and take shelter of Krishna, wherever in anxiety, distress, we'll always be chanting Hare Krishna. Because that's the nature of the age. There's always anxiety and distress. So Jiva Goswami describes that's a blessing. That's the specific blessing of Kali Yuga. In that sense. That there's so much distress and there's so much difficulty that we're driven to take shelter of Krishna's names. So let's do it. Jai Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu Nityananda Prabhu Srila Prabhupada Srimad Bhagavatam Ki Jai Harinam Prabhu Ki Jai. In previous ages, people enjoyed in the mode of goodness. So therefore, there was actually happiness attached to the enjoyment. But now, all the enjoyment is in passion and ignorance, which brings so much distress. So much distress. And that, in its own way, is a blessing.